Golf Smarter number 339, published on June 26, 2012, is brought to you by our Golfer's Mart, now featuring the greatest divot tool in the universe, the Golf Smarter Switchblade Divot Repair Tool with removable ball marker, available at golfsmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com, delivering sound advice.
Can swing changes really lower your scores? With Jim Waldron.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome back to the Golf Smarter podcast, Jim.
Thanks, Fred. Great to be back with you again.
You have a topic in mind and contacted me to cover this. I just love that idea. And that is all about what's been going on with Tiger Woods' swing changes over the last couple of years. But also you wanted to talk about how that affects us as the average golfer.
Yeah, how it affects the average golfer and what it takes to make a swing change. You know, what do you have to do to go through this process of working with a teacher, which is in the news right now, because especially – you know, we actually talked about doing this before Tiger's win last week in Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
But how perfect timing! You know, he comes from sort of in the middle of the pack, and then just blows the field away at Memorial, which was kind of cool, I thought.
Yeah, and but the press over the number of years over his career, because he's made multiple swing changes, coach changes, and then swing changes. He's done this multiple times, and the press has been relentless on him. Like, why are you doing this? You're the best player out there. Why would you do this?
Right. You know, and I find that the whole topic of how and why you go about working with a teacher, being one myself, obviously, to make a swing change, to be really fascinating, and also an area that the golfing public is sorely lacking in real knowledge about. And because there's that lack of this sort of body of knowledge, and I'm not talking so much about the technical information, obviously that's part of it, but more about the psychology and the philosophy of how you go about making a swing change, which is very, very seldom discussed. And hence we have this sort of rift between the golf media and Tiger being the example we're going to use today. Every press conference, they ask him the same question, and he pretty much responds with, you got to give the guy credit, quite a bit. More patience than I would have. And he uses the term process a lot. And he used it with, when he was with Butch, and he used it with Haney. And now he's using it with Sean Foley. And I'll give you a great example. A couple of weeks ago, I forget what tournament it was, but it was the one or two before Memorial. Someone asked him, a reporter, Tiger, I don't understand why you're going through all these technical changes with Sean. Why don't you just go do what you did when you were a kid, when you didn't have a teacher? You weren't thinking mechanics all the time, and you just went out and trusted your swing and played golf. And there was this long pause, and Tiger sort of looked down. And I'm thinking, because I know the history of this guy. And he said what I was thinking. He said, well, first of all, your premise is totally wrong. I've never not had a teacher. I've always worked on the process of making my swing better. My first teacher from age 18 months until about, I think he said, like age 7 or 8 was his dad, who was a good player. And then he went to a guy named Rudy Durion. Then he had a guy in high school. And then he went to Butch when he was 17 years old. Then he left Butch and pretty quickly. I think he was alone for only a year without a teacher. And then he went to Haney. And now he left Haney and went to Foley. So he said, I've always had a teacher. I've always worked on improving my technique. And this idea you guys have that I have this sort of natural talent that if I just stop getting in my own way and go play golf, I'll be perfectly fine, is just basically wrong.
Amazing. So where do we go with that? You know, I mean, because when I'm, you know, thinking about it and talking about it and playing with people, I don't think people go so, you know, the average golfer goes so much through swing changes as tweaks.
Correct.
And my favorite is when they try to tweak it themselves, thinking they know what's going on.
Right. Well, part of what I'm trying to do in my golfing mission in life is to educate the golfing public about some stuff that I've acquired, kind of a body of knowledge I've acquired and other good teachers I know have acquired over the years that they've been involved in golf and teaching golf. You know, and the average student that I get and that my teaching buddies get just doesn't know this stuff. We talked about this in the past, and more about some other areas, but specifically, what does it take in terms of sort of categories of thought? How do you sort of compartmentalize your understanding of what you're about to engage in when you want to improve some aspect of your game? And most often that's improving your ball striking. That's the big demand in the golfing instruction marketplace, is for ball striking improvement, much more than, say, putting improvement or short game improvement or mental game improvement. But that's, in fact, that is one of these things that people should know. There's four major skill areas: putting, short game, ball striking or long game, and mental game. And, you know, if you're going to embark on a game improvement plan, one of the decisions as a student you have to make is, which of those four areas do I want to engage in as my primary sort of big change strategy? Because if you're working for a living still, if you're not retired, you don't have time to work on changing all four of those. You know, you only have time to work on one of those major skill categories.
And I've always thought that it's almost impossible. Well, not impossible, but it's so rare when all four of them work in any round of golf.
Yeah, that's true, too. You know, one of my little sort of things, like little bits of wisdom I try to impart is, look, you know, spend 80% roughly of your practice time on the one big change, capital B, capital C, that you're working on in one of those four major skill areas, and spend the other 20% of your practice time just trying to maintain your current level of skill in those other three skill areas.
Hmm.
And just doing that, it just pushes the whole game improvement process to another, into a higher level. Because a lot of it's about, how do I apportion my time and my energy so I can train my way to better golf. You know, and that's one of those examples I always use in terms of a body of knowledge. People need to know some of this stuff, right? Here's another one people don't know about making swing changes. There's two major kinds of instruction. And one is called fundamental instruction, which is basically learning what the rules or the laws of proper body motion and proper club motion are. And the alternative approach is called swing corrective instruction, which is where you're not really trying to do a radical change. You're trying to do more of a moderate to superficial change to your existing golf swing. You're not going to change from one of the four swing styles to a completely different swing style. Everybody has one of these four swing styles, which we'll talk about in a minute, but you're trying to stay with the swing you currently have, but basically polish it, or as you said, refine it, kind of tweak it. And there's effective rules for how you go about doing that type of training that are different than the rules you need to train on making more radical changes, more fundamental changes, right? There's pros and cons of each approach.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I think, you know, the golfing public out there needs to know what those pros and cons are before they can make an informed decision about which of those two they want to work with is their main sort of strategy. And this should all be done in advance before you even talk to a new teacher about taking lessons or a golf school, I think. It should be information you've already sort of digested, right? Well, let's talk about those four styles. There's been four ways of swinging the golf club that have worked historically, that have won majors. I call them in no particular order. I'll start with the most common. The one you see today in about 95% of tour pros, both males and females, probably, I don't know, 75% of low handicap, you know, really good low handicap amateur players, I call leverage spinning or leverage spin. It's a swing that has very, very few moving parts, an on-plane club shaft, a club shaft that stays on the original plane angle relative to the ground from start to finish, or pretty close to that. Fairly wide arms at the top of the backswing, you know, not close to the body, but kind of pushing the arms away from the body at the top. That's one of the levers that are a potential source of club head speed. Full wrist cock, but a very active rotation. That's the spin part of the body, especially in the forward swing, with the upper arms connected to the chest. There's an extreme version of that, which is another one of the four styles, which is based on Hogan's swing, which is basically not so wide with the arms and even more rotation of the body. That's today's probably Zach Johnson and Jonathan Bird, Chad Campbell are the probably three modern players who exemplify that style the most. Then there's a style we call the slinging or the throwing style, which is young Jack Nicklaus. The only great player today who's using that, younger player, is Bubba Watson. So there's lots of independent arm motion, lots of independent leg motion.
Does Bubba know? Does Bubba even know that he's doing that? I mean, Bubba claims to never take lessons, never look at his swing in
video. That's something else. I'm willing to buy he's never paid someone who calls himself a teaching pro to take a formal lesson. But don't forget, he had a high school golf course coach and a college golf coach, and all those guys coached their students. So he's had instruction. I think it's probably been of the more informal variety, more of the swing-corrective type as opposed to the fundamental type. But to think that he's never taken a lesson is just ridiculous. Of course he has. It's just that they've been informal, you know.
The guy's won the Masters. But, I mean,
you
don't
but
get
that
to that
style
point.
Is the, you know, that's the most moving parts, and that's why you don't see it very much anymore, because it takes so much more talent and so much more timing to hit the ball solid with that style that it's really a throwback to another era. And you're not going to see that many more people. I mean, the only other guy I can think of who actually uses that style today, he's somewhat of an older player now, almost a senior, is Colin Montgomery. Those are the only two guys on the tour today who have won majors with that in the modern era in the last, say, 20 years.
God, Colin Montgomery is still playing. Colin Montgomery is still playing
on the tour. Yeah, he hasn't won in a while.
Yeah, he's still playing. Haven't heard his name in a while.
Yeah, I know. And then there's what I call a thrusting, and sometimes I call it a hitting style, which is guys who are extreme endomorph, which are you know, the most inflexible of the three body types. They tend to have deep barrel-type chests, wide shoulder girdles. Overall, they lack a lot of flexibility, so they can't use a rotary-style swing because they don't have the flexibility to rotate. And so someone like Rocco Mediate or Duffy Waldorf or Craig Stadler, they do what I call a thrust style. They still pivot, don't get me wrong. I mean, all four styles use the pivot as the primary source of power, but these are more secondary differences we're talking about. You got to decide which of those four styles you're going to use, because some teachers only teach one of the four, and they don't teach the other three at all. I prefer never to teach the slinging or the throwing, you know, the Bubba style, although if I'm working with someone who's already about maybe a 12, 10 handicap or better, and they just want to tweak it, I know enough about that style to be able to tweak it. But if someone's higher than a 12, or roughly a 12, I'll usually try to change into a simpler method. If they're willing to put the time in, obviously, because it takes time to make the swing change, which is what one of the big things I wanted to talk about. Tiger brings it up. He says, you know, hey, guys, it takes time. I'm changing a neuromuscular path, or several neuromuscular pathways, from my existing old-style neuromuscular pathways, and that literally takes lots and lots of repetitions, lots of patience, lots of persistence, lots of perseverance, and eventually I'll form, you know, either a dominant habit or a close-to-dominant habit, which is apparently what he's doing now with this second win of the year at Memorial, which he led in greens and regulation, he led in total driving, he led in driving distance. He hit a ton of fairways with his driver, which you know, always in the past, that was his big weakness.
Yeah, traditionally, that's not what he does the best, yeah.
Yeah.
It also looked in that event that he led in confidence, too.
Yes, I was just going to say, and that's the other big issue. And, you know, that's one of those chicken and egg arguments. So how do you get confidence, you know?
Right.
And I always talk about the John Wooden, Bobby Knight basketball, two opposing ideas about confidence. You know, Bobby Knight's idea was he had a sign in the locker room saying confidence is BS, meaning you got confident because you worked on the mechanics of dribbling, shooting, passing, free throws. That's how you got confidence, by improving your physical mechanics of the sport of basketball. And when you really get better at those skill areas, you see improvement. You score more points. You win more games. You pass better, you shoot better, you dribble better, you play defense better, you block shots better because your technique is better, and then you get the confidence, right? So it's sort of like the confidence, the end result of this process of physical skill acquisition. Whereas John Wooden believed, and I think more correctly, that you can practice confidence as a fundamental, a mental game fundamental of basketball that's completely separate from whatever current skill level you have in terms of the mechanical skills of the game of basketball. And, you know, in my approach, balance point, right? I teach both.
Sure.
You can get confident by improving your technique, and you can get confident by not doing anything in your technique, just leaving your technique alone and just working on accessing that state of confidence during the early stages of your pre-shot routine and staying with that state of confidence until the finish of your golf swing. Both methods work, so why not use both? That's kind of, they're not exclusionary in my opinion. But anyhow, so you know, you got to figure out which of these four swing styles you're going to work with, because they have some of their components are not compatible with the other three swing styles, and you don't want to, right?
I just want to ask you a question: is can the recreational golfer, the average golfer, can they determine for themselves which one that they want to do? Or do they need to have an instructor to say, in watching what you've been doing, here's what I think would be best for you to focus on?
Well, I think it's, again, it's sort of in the middle there. I mean, obviously, if they have zero knowledge of golf swing theory and they don't have the interest or the time to study books or go online, read some of the web forums where these issues are discussed in depth, then they pretty much have to go with what the teacher recommends. But if they want to do a little investigative research and study some of the stuff that's on the web, look at some YouTube videos, it quickly becomes apparent of which of these four styles that they're more likely to want to gravitate towards. Some of it has to do with body type, obviously, which is a physical limitation. Uh-huh. Again, if you're an extreme endo, you don't have a choice. You've got to use the thrust or the hitting style. If you're a moderate endo, the only style that's probably going to work for you is the leverage spin. The only people that can do the ultra spin, which is the Hogan, sort of Hogan 4.0, you know, the modern version of the Hogan swing, are people who are extremely flexible with extremely strong cores and have a natural ability to rotate or to turn their body on the forward swing, especially at a very fast tempo. So fast tempo is part of that type of ultra spin swing style.
And my guess is my guess is that comes from starting to play golf when you're very young. I mean, pick up the game, and later in life, I've talked about, I started when I was playing 40. I got an email from a listener recently who said, I beat you. I started playing when I was 60. You know, but it's not those, we're not those kind that are going to be the ultra flexible, you know.
Correct. Well, that's why I tell most people, I just say, look, you know, of the four styles, probably 95% or more of the population should choose the leverage spin. It's actually the easiest to learn of the four by far. Mm-hmm. Takes the least amount of practice time to get pretty good at. And you can do it with any body type except the extreme endomorph. And extreme endomorphs are probably less than 1% of the population. So, but the reason I say that is you may go to a teacher who only teaches the old 1960s leg drive, reverse C, Johnny Miller, Tony Lima, Jack Nicklaus slinging or throwing style. There are older teachers, guys my age who are a little older, who only teach that. And they'll tell you to drive your legs for power. They'll tell you to swing your arms across your chest through impact. A lot of stuff that I think is, you know, it takes well above average athletic ability to do well and still hit the ball solid. Although obviously Bubba does it, right? He's sort of like a freak of nature, right? But for the average person, I mean, the average person is already kind of doing sort of the natural golf swing that everybody brings to the table, except for extreme endomorphs, is the slinging style. It's a very leggy, very armsy type of swing. And the practice ranges of the entire planet are full of people who are 25 handicaps and higher, who are trying to do that swing style, and they're never going to get any better. I mean, no matter how much they practice. So obviously I'm not a fan of that one.
Right.
Because again, it's from a biomechanical standpoint, it has the most moving parts. It tends to be the hardest to stay in balance. It requires the most timing, you know, and timing issues and balance issues are two of the big reasons why average golfers can't hit the ball solid. Anyhow, so that's stuff you have to know, you know, either whether you work directly with a teacher or without a teacher, you've got to know that there's these four main styles and what the pros and cons of each. And then you got to decide, do I want to do a tweaking or a corrective type approach, which is more about finding one or more flaws and then doing basically the opposite. So, you know, it's the old saying in golf, how do you teach people not to slice? The answer is you teach them how to hook it. That's swing corrective. This is like Butch Harmon is sort of the premier swing corrective coach in the game today. Not that he doesn't teach some of the fundamentals. Obviously, he does that as well. But once the grip is there, the grip pressure, the spine angle, you know, the posture, the setup, some of the basic balance stuff, he basically does what his dad taught him to do, which is find what the person's doing wrong and get him to stop doing it. Right? It takes the least amount of time to start to see some degree of immediate improvement to the ball flight. The problem is sometimes, quite often, in fact, it tends to be kind of band-aid-y. It tends to be short-term improvement. And after you invest a little bit of time on the range working on these swing flaw corrective exercises, they tend not to manifest into long-term permanent changes. In other words, the band-aid tends to come off. So that's the downside to it.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you this. Because you not only have individual students that come to you on a regular basis, hopefully, you also, the Balance Point Golf Schools, you'll have people come out for 2, 3, 5 days, correct?
Right.
So my question is, when people, from your observation, when golfers come out to a 5-day school, are they looking for a swing change or a swing fix? Unlike somebody who's committed to coming to you every week for a year or two. I mean, like, they're just totally committed. What do you see as the norm, and what do you see,
Well, I mean, you got to remember, because I'm so clear about this issue on our website, and I talk to every new student who signs up on the phone for usually at least 30 minutes, sometimes an hour or two in advance, I try to disabuse them of the notion they're going to come to school and form a dominant habit. And, you know, and the joke I always say at every school, I say, well, if you're expecting to have a Tour Pro quality golf swing when you leave here in 3 days, you came to the wrong school. That's our $1 million tuition school. So if you're expecting a miracle, you're going to pay for it, right?
Yeah, right.
Meaning it's impossible. You can't get to that level of you can't get even 50% of dominant habit. You might get 10% there after 3 days. Mm-hmm. But to get to the 50% mark, which is where most people will be really happy and see a lot of improvement, you're talking like, you know, 9 months, a year, year and a half of training after they graduate to get to that level. Because, again, we're talking about changing, you know, we're creating new neuromuscular pathways. You're literally changing the physiology of how your brain and body work together. So most of those people already know that. So I would put it this way. Part of their ego, hopefully a small part, is sort of hoping I'm sort of not telling them the 100% truth about that, and they're kind of hoping a miracle is going to happen. But I think that's a pretty tiny part of their conscious mind. I think for the most part, they're not expecting a miracle.
Right. And yeah. Just it doesn't make sense, because, you know, in my mind, golf schools, you can correct, you can fix, you can learn a lot, but then you have to go back and work on it on your own. I mean,
correct.
And I know that you will continue the conversation. You will look at videos, you know, of people, but still, you're not there. And really, I really believe that if you're going to be working with a coach, you're not going to learn a lot. You're not going to be able to correct things by watching YouTube videos or the Golf Channel. You really need to have somebody who's going to be there and hold your hand and say, and literally hold your hands and guide your hands, you know, get you through that.
Yeah, that's right. So we tell people you need follow-up lessons, either in person or by YouTube, where we talk on the phone after I analyze, which works fine for people who have been through the program because they have all the conceptual knowledge, you know, they know. So if I say, okay, your arm extension's, you know, too narrow at this point, or if I say you come out of your spine angle 4 inches at this point, or you flipped your wrist, they know what I'm talking about because they've been through that 3 days of intensive training. But anyhow, so that's the downside of swing corrective. It tends not to last. And that doesn't mean it never lasts. Sometimes it does last. I'm just saying that's a precondition that people that's an aspect of swing corrective approach that any educated golfer should be aware of, that it may not be permanent improvement if the underlying fundamental, that's the basis for the swing flaw, is so absent. You know, it's like building a house without putting a foundation down. I mean, the fundamentals are the foundation, and when you're patching a hole in the roof, that's the swing corrective. So in our golf schools, we do, you know, probably about 10 to 20% of the time is swing corrective, and the other 80 to 90 is fundamental training. And in private lessons, it's just the opposite. It's probably, you know, I don't know, 60 or 70% swing corrective, and the rest of it's fundamentals. And then the other thing is people should be aware of that there's what we call them the three master fundamentals. I mean, this applies to mainly the golf swing, but also to the short game and a little bit to putting, which is there's three sort of, you know, in terms of physical skill of the golf swing, there's balance issues, there's mechanical issues, and there's coordination or timing issues. So an example of timing or coordination would be tempo, which is, you know, the length of time of your swing from start to finish. Rhythm, which is that there's a difference in time between the length of your backswing and then from top of backswing to impact. So there's a sort of an internal beat or a rhythm that your body moves to in order to time your golf swing properly. So you arrive at impact with a square club face, right? And there's some other ones, the proper sequence of motion of your forward swing body parts. So that's coordination. Balance is self-explanatory. You set up in balance. You stay in balance dynamically all the way up to and including the finish. Really important fundamental. And there's the mechanics, which is how the individual body parts move in the golf swing. So, you know, you don't want to be trying to, like, do a little bit of each. I mean, again, you're going to try to pick one of those three areas as your main sort of focus for your practice time. Is it going to be that you have a balance issue? Is it going to be that you have a mechanical issue? Or do you have a tempo, rhythm, or timing issue? Because, again, if you're working for a living, you don't have time to do all three. It's just not going to happen, right?
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like the whole jack-of-all-trades, master-of-none thing. You want to avoid that. You want to be a master of one, right?
Right. Right.
And then back to Tiger, you know, the big thing he keeps telling people
right,
is...
Oh, right, Tiger.
Yeah, he obviously has done exactly what I do in my golf schools. If you study what he's done with Foley, now they keep it pretty close to their vest, both he and Foley, but they have done, you know, enough interviews with individual journalists and plus the press conferences. They've let some of the information they're working on kind of leak out. And so it's sort of a kind of maybe, I don't know what the exact percentage is, but it looks like it's close to 50-50. It's like roughly 50% radical swing changes for Tiger, which you can clearly see now. If you look at his swing now on YouTube from last week in slow-mo and look in, you know, 2000 when he was winning everything.
Yeah, and when you say last week, again, like, let's clarify that we're talking about the Memorial in
the Memorial,
May of 2012.
Correct.
Versus
correct,
the swing in 2000.
Okay. But the point is, if you compare that swing, this present-day swing, to 12 years ago, it doesn't even look like the same person. It's completely different. And in my opinion, it's much, much better. It's better from a biomechanical standpoint. It's better from a geometry standpoint. The club shaft stays on plane throughout the swing. For his old swing, it was moving around a lot. It made a lot of shifts and loops and kind of dips. And his old swing was way more leggy and especially more armsy. He's basically got his arms under control. That was probably the biggest thing that I know of. Again, they may have been working on stuff they haven't told anybody about. I can't, you know, I'm not inside Sean Foley's head or in Tiger's head, so I'm sort of guessing here. I'm speculating. But what I can see so far is that, and they have talked about this a little bit, is the biggest difference is his arms are trailing the right amount behind his body, not too far behind, which is what his big problem was before, on the way down. And then he would pull his arms across his chest, trying to get him to catch up with his body. And if he did it too much, he'd hit a pull hook. If he didn't do enough, he'd hit a push or a block slice. They fixed that lack of synchronization issue between his arm motion and the downswing and his body motion. So now his body and arms are more in sync. The club is more in front of his body. And he doesn't have to sling his arms across his chest to try to square the face. All he's doing is turning his body while his upper arms stay glued to his chest, kind of like how Hogan discovered back in the 1930s. So he's more connected on the forward swing through impact. That's the number one biggest change. And the other is more of a swing corrective. He's not dropping his spine angle like he used to. If you looked at him even for a few months ago when he was kind of in a bit of a slump there, and some of those shots they showed on the TV broadcast, he was dropping. He was increasing the angle of his spine forward toward the ground by like 10 inches. So, you know, if he doesn't stand up at least by 6 or 7 inches, he's going to hit it really fat, right? He's going to drive the club directly into the ground, which he would occasionally do. He would occasionally hit a driver where the club would bounce off the ground like 5-6 inches behind the ball.
Something that we do all the time.
Yeah, the average people do, right?
Oh, my God, yes.
So, although for a different reason. Most people don't increase their spine. The average person listening to this broadcast does the opposite of Tiger's flaw. Instead of dipping, increasing their spine angle, they're coming out of it. Mm-hmm. And the reason they hit the ground is because they throw their wrist cock angle away way before their hands get below waist high in the downswing. Anytime you stay in your spine angle, don't dip, don't stand up, stay level, but you throw your wrist cock angle away before your hands pass below waist high in the downswing, you're going to steepen the club shaft plane angle. The shaft's going to get more upright relative to the ground than it was when you started. In effect, it's going to get, you know, 2, 3, 4 inches longer in effective length, which means you're going to hit the ground, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That's one common reason why average golfers hit it fat. Yeah. So anyhow, so that's what I see. He's less armsy. He's fixed, not completely, but he's much better on the spine angle issue. And the other big change is
hold that thought,
which is sort of a
hold that thought. Other right. big because we've hit our time limit here, and please hold that thought. And I would love to continue the conversation on a members only episode. Could you hang around and we continue?
You bet.
This?
I'll do it.
Awesome.
Yeah, it'd be fun.
So listen, this is so fascinating, and I always enjoy speaking with you, Jim. And I hope and really think that the audience, the Golf Smarter community, appreciates what you have to share with us as well. And so if you are not one of those Golf Smarter listeners that have joined Golf Smarter for members only, this is a good time to really consider why you haven't, because the community is growing, it's larger, and there's a lot of Golf Smarter listeners who are also Golf Smarter members because of these kind of episodes that are so good that it goes on and there's so much that we can get from it. So I implore you, if you haven't joined yet, please consider it. Go to golfsmarter.com and become a member and help this listener-supported podcast continue. And Jim, we will continue this conversation on the next episode of the Golf Smarter podcast, please.
Fantastic.
Golf Smarter members were just introduced to a new Golf Smarter product and the 25% discount that they receive. So let me tell you about a golf product that exceeds my personal requirements of form, function, and coolness. Hat? No. Towel? Eh. If you've been listening for the last few years, then you already know about the eco-friendly and ego-friendly Dixon balls with the Golf Smarter logo. Now, meet the greatest divot repair tool ever. Here are the immediate benefits of the Golf Smarter divot repair tool. One, you immediately become a highly regarded golf citizen because this durable and high-tech switchblade makes you look classy when you clean up ball marks around the green. Number two, because the removable ball marker with the Golf Smarter logo has a very large number one on it, you instantly become a better and more confident putter because when you see the marker, it reminds you to repeat to yourself, one putt, one putt, one putt. Number three, because it's a switchblade, you won't be bruising your leg or poking holes in your pants with the standard boring divot tool. And number four, and in just a few days since our introduction, this has become the primary reason for buying in bulk, you become a Golf Smarter ambassador to your foursome and the alternates by sharing stories and tips that you've heard on your favorite golf podcast. So please, get in your order today for one or five of the brand new Golf Smarter Greatest Switchblade Divot Repair Tool ever at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.